Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Senator Michael Gianaris, a Democrat from New York's 12th District and Deputy Majority Leader in the State Senate, and a guy who I have admired for many years for his stick-to-itiveness. Welcome, Senator Michael Gianaris.
Alan, thanks for having me on. Good to talk with you again.
Okay, so let me start by going to the things that I consider to be sort of most important. First of all, you're making a lot of news because you think that the governor probably did the wrong thing, the governor and whoever else, by giving Amazon such an incredibly large amount of tax breaks. So let's get that one out of the way first.
Yeah, well, I do. I think you characterized it correctly. The governor and the mayor and their economic development agencies participated in this beauty contest that Amazon set up for the last year, and ended up promising them what will be well in excess, ultimately, of $3 billion in incentives, some as of right, some discretionary. But they really opened up the purse strings for them, and I don't think Amazon needs it. I don't think Amazon deserves it. And I think we ended up making some poor decisions when we need money for improvements to New York, improvements for the subways, improvements for affordable housing, improvements for our schools. We have great needs with our budget dollars, and we're sitting here forking them over to Amazon. Just by way of comparison, Google promised 20,000 jobs to New York recently. Amazon's number is 25. And they didn't get any incentives to do all this. So the question is, what makes Amazon so special that they get to raid our taxpayer dollars for this project? I think it's a huge mistake.
Can it be undone?
Well, that's a good question. The state and the city are both working very hard to avoid any approvals that may normally be necessary. They're bypassing the city government entirely. There's normally a land use process that would kick in that they are bypassing. And then the question is, what do they need from the state budget, which obviously involves the legislature? What do they need from board approvals that oversee some of the authorities and agencies that the state has? And that's an open question because it sounds like they're trying to avoid those entities as much as possible. Ultimately, the programs that the state wants to use to fund these incentives need to be renewed, need to be reappropriated. But that could be a couple of years down the line from what we're hearing. So we're kind of pouring over all the details and trying to figure out when exactly someone's approval other than the state and the city executives are necessary.
So you're number two in the state Senate now, as soon as January comes. Can you use that or will you use that office to do it? And if you do, part B on your blue book question is, will the governor, who is known for not taking prisoners, get mad at you?
Well, what we should realize is I'm not coming at this as a member of leadership, although I certainly am, and I'm proud of it. But I'm also the senator for the district where they want to place this facility.
First
and foremost, I'm representing my community, which is up in arms about this. People are very unhappy that this is coming. They're very worried about what it means for their community, because if it doesn't take much in the age of the internet to go look at and to research what's happened in Seattle, what's happened in San Francisco, where these tech companies completely take over a community and push everybody else out. We are already getting reports that small businesses that were on the verge of signing contracts to locate in Long Island City are being turned away by the landlords now because they are expecting that rents will skyrocket and they could get a better deal. People who have lived in those communities for decades are going to start getting pushed out because everything's going to become less and less affordable as a result of this deal. So I come at it from the point of view as I'm a senator representing my community, just like 62 other senators will be doing, and I intend to fight this deal.
So you are, as we always say, a representative or representative, and that's very important, right? You take the pulse of your community, you find out what they want, and you do it. Is that basically it?
Well, I'm also a member of the community, so it's more than just taking the pulse. I'm not just taking a poll and acting accordingly. I am in touch and a member of this community. I've lived here my whole life, and I like everyone else, is very concerned about what this means and how it's happening and why it's happening. Amazon itself has said publicly they did not come here for the incentives. They came here because this is where the talent is. This is where the workforce is that they need to make this successful. That's why Google's here. That's why Facebook is expanding here. I don't know why we have to do all this for Amazon, simply because they set up a process, which I have called one of the great PR scams I've seen, where they made everyone kind of parade around and tell them how much money they're going to get to go to their city. And they're calling it a headquarters. How many headquarters is one company allowed to have? They have the one in Seattle. They have now one in Virginia they're going to put in, another one in New York. It's just an outpost. It's another office for them, and in a location where the talent is there that they need to succeed. But by calling it a headquarters and by making everyone bid against each other, they've succeeded in sucking billions of dollars out of taxpayers who need it for a lot of other things.
Now, you've talked about real estate being an important component of this, Michael. But in addition, there are other things that will be screwed up. I mean, for example, the subway trains. How do you get from Long Island City now? What line do you take to get to New York?
Well, there's a few. The seven line is the main line that most people take. There are a couple of others in other parts of Long Island City. But the 7 is the lifeblood of Long Island City, and of Sunnyside, by the way, which is the neighboring community. Those trains are already packed to capacity. If you were to go there in the morning rush and look at the platform, it looks like one of those amusement park games where the quarters are being pushed to the edge of the platform, except it's human bodies we're talking about. People are already piled up, up the stairs and onto the street, because there's just not enough trains, not enough room, and we're at capacity. That neighborhood has maybe 60,000 people in it today. We're talking about adding 25,000 people to the mix. And I've heard some of the economic development folks try and delay that concern by saying, well, there'll be reverse commuting because right now people are going from Queens to Manhattan and this will be the other way. That's just false. First of all, a number of these people will, in fact, live in Long Island City. That's just going to happen. And the bulk of the rest will live farther out into Queens, which means they are going to be on the same trains coming in the same direction as everybody else and further burdening the subways than they already are. Now, I happen to sit on a task force that's about to issue a report about the MTA and what we need to do to get the subway system back on track in a direction it needs to go. We are banging our heads against the wall trying to find two nickels to rub together to pay for the improvements the subways need. And yet, at the snap of a finger, we could locate $3 billion to give to Amazon. It's incredibly frustrating, Alan.
Okay, so I have an honesty question, Mike, which is defined as, if you don't come clean on this, a lightning bolt will come out of the air and head right towards you. So has the governor talked to you about this? Because it's obviously...
I knew you were powerful and important, Alan. I didn't know you could shoot lightning bolts out of the sky.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have spoken many times with representatives of the governor who are involved in this project, and I assume they speak for him. So I guess that's a way of saying, yes, I've had conversations with them about this.
Okay, Mike, I want to move on to something that I've been watching for many years now, and that was the emergence of something that drove me as crazy as drove you, and that was a group of Democrats who cited become a chairman of a committee or whatever, and you stood your ground. You really did, and everybody knew you were furious about it, and you've won. You feel good?
It's very rare in politics that outcomes are so clean and decisive, but yes, we just came off our conference retreat in advance of the session in a couple of weeks so we could prepare for our agenda. And in the years I've been in the Senate, I have never seen a more unified group with such great chemistry. 40% of our conference are new, and I think that's refreshing and great, because you, as a longtime observer, know that sometimes you get bogged down in the ways of Albany and can't imagine that things can be different. But these new members are coming in with a very fresh perspective. And when I just saw it in the last couple of days when we were together, when someone would say, well, this is how it's done, they would pop up and say, well, why does it have to be done that way? And those are great questions to ask. And I'm looking forward to impressing people with our majority and impressing the cynics who think everything is going to be the way it's always been. We are anxious to break the mold in Albany and set a new tone for an open, transparent, and government focused on reform, at least in our conference.
So let's talk about that reform. We know how it's worked in the past, right? The Assembly Democrats, knowing that the Republicans in the Senate, when they were controlling things, would say no, so they pass ethics reforms, they do all that stuff. But most of those guys got, or you people, women, men, got there under the old rules. And, you know, do they really need somebody running against them because of ethics reform? So my question to you is, your leader, Andrea Stewart Cousins, comes out and says, we've really got to pass these things now. Does she mean it?
Of course she means it. If you know Andrea, anyone that knows her knows this is why she's a great leader. She says what she means. She doesn't overpromise. She is not someone who engages in political BS. I'll save you the curse words for your show and your listeners. But
we can be both. Yeah.
but she's a very straightforward person, and if she can't tell you what you want to hear, she's not afraid to upset people. But when she says something, she means it. We are a group that is very interested in making these changes. We're hopefully Assembly joins us in that effort, and we'll be able to do something that people can be proud of.
Yeah, you know, we don't want to see we don't want to see a sort of hypocrisy coming out of all of this. That, you know, it's one thing when you're out of office, it's another thing when you're in office. I remember the last time we spoke, I guess I said to you, when you win, because I knew you would, will you do unto them as they done unto you? In other words, the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Will you? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you intend to make it more inclusive or not?
Well, look, so let's just take a step back for a second. Some of the way the legislature is governed is based on the majority governing, and that's sure. just a result of the elections. And so will the Republicans have as much to say about what we pass as the majority? Of course not.
No.
We never did, and they won't, because the people don't want their agenda advanced as much as they want our agenda advanced. That's what the election showed. And in a very dramatic way, if we could just divert for a second, sure. our majority is the largest Democratic majority in over 100 years. And the largest majority period that I've seen since I've been following state legislative politics. So it was a decisive win. The mandate is clear. And I think we'll be fair to all our colleagues and let them discharge their responsibilities as legislators responsibly. But at the end of the day, when it comes to setting the agenda, we're going to do what the electorate asked for when it voted.
Okay, I'm going to give you a two-word question, and there'll be a question mark after it, and you then have to tell us what's going on. Simca Felder.
He has been speaking to our leader. At this point, there's no change in his status. Our conference is 39 strong, as I talked to you today. The committee assignments were given out. A lot of people noticed he was not among them because he is not a member of our conference. And so as we go into January, I don't know if things may or may not change, but at this point, there's no change in his status.
I know that, you know, people have been furious with him because he did run as a Democrat most of the time, and he did also run as a Republican, I guess, the last time. But he then went across the line and worked with the Republicans and said, I'll do what's best for my community. What do you mean by that?
You'll have to ask him what he meant by that. But
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, I can't speak for him. I don't know what goes through his head, certainly. But we have 39 people who were elected with a mandate. That mandate was a Democratic agenda, and these 39 people were elected with the knowledge that they would sit with the Democratic conference. And we just had a tremendous gathering of our members to set the agenda. So we're moving ahead. And whether we have 39 or 40 is somewhat inconsequential in terms of our ability to govern. So I understand the political interest in what happens with him and where does he sit. But functionally speaking, it's not relevant. It's not like we're sitting at 31 or 32 and every number counts. We have a sizable majority with or without him, and we intend to move forward regardless.
So, Senator Michael Gianaris, let me ask you about the pay raise. You know, there are many people who think that the legislature, who hasn't had a pay raise for a long, long time, deserves a pay raise. I happen to think even the governor deserves his pay raise to $250,000. Hey, we have doctors running hospitals for $1 million. However, there is a insistence by the governor and others like me, not that I have anything to say about it, but who say, well, okay, but no outside income, because that's an invitation to graft. People hire the senator or hire the assemblyman as the lawyer, for example, because they think they're going to get something extra out of it. How do you feel about all that?
Oh, that's been our longstanding position. We've tried to force votes when we were in the minority on bans and outside income. And our leader just before this commission issued its report, publicly said that we continue to support a ban on outside income. And so that has been something we've supported a long time. I've been in the legislature between the Assembly and the Senate almost 20 years. I have never taken a penny of outside income, even though I'm an attorney, because I treat it as a full-time job. And so I don't have any problem with that at all.
You know, on your website, you have prominently talked about immigration and how important immigration is, certainly in New York City. We have Ellis Island. We have everything else. You're Greek, right?
I am. My parents are immigrants, in fact. So, yes, I'm first generation, born in the U.S.
And you are the pride. I happen to know you're the pride of the Greek community who think that you're the best. So you're confronted with a guy like Trump who has made immigrant and tried to make immigrant into a bad word. Give us some thinking on this.
Well, so much of immigration policy is controlled by the federal government, so we have some limitations on what we can do. Ultimately, the best thing we can do to improve immigration policy is defeat Donald Trump in 2 years, and I think all of us will be working very hard to make that happen. But there are some things we can do at the state level to push back, and we've certainly tried to do that, and we'll continue to try to do that. And that involves pieces of state legislation we could advance. You know, I have suggested when the travel ban was in place that the facilities and assets of the state not be used to help enforce that. There's all certain things we can do to resist those policies, because especially in New York, this is it wasn't just my parents that came here. There's millions of immigrants have used New York as the portal to greater opportunity in the United States.
And my grandparents.
It's important it's important for our identity to maintain that. You mentioned the Greek community. We are proud. I'll divert again for a second just to point out we have the largest Greek contingent in the Senate. Probably in history. There's three of us on the Democratic side, and I found out recently that Daphne Jordan is also of Greek heritage. So there's four of us in the Senate, and I know that's a point of pride for the community. But every community has its own points of pride. We have the first Indian American who got elected. We have the first Chinese American in John Liu who got elected to the Senate just this past election. We have a Salvadoran woman, Monica Martinez, who got elected. So our conference reflects the diversity and the openness to immigration that our state and our country are known for. So I think you can expect us to be focusing on that a great deal.
So Trump is always talking, you know, we are always thinking about Trump and his base. Everything's because of the base. And the assumption is anti-immigration policy is to the base. What's that about? I mean, are there really 40% of Americans who support a guy who is this xenophobic?
Elections are determined by who turns out to vote. And what we saw in the midterms is people are coming out to vote. A base-only strategy works if only the bases are voting. Mm. And because Trump is so bad as the president, a lot of people are coming out to vote to the point where the turnout just last month was approaching presidential election levels, which is unprecedented. And I think when we roll into 2020 and it's an actual presidential election, we're going to be setting records in terms of turnout. When everyone votes, these base-only strategies don't work because that's only so much of the electorate is fired up by one person. There's a lot of people who are now fired up just as well on the other side, and a whole bunch of people in the middle who are embarrassed by what this man has done to our country.
Senator Michael Gianaris is with us. Mike, criminal justice. There are many people who think that things are out of whack, that too many people of color are in prison, that the parole system is broken. Is there going to be a real attempt to fix all of that?
There certainly will be. I happen to carry and have authored legislation to eliminate bail in New York, for example. But I think bail, speedy trial reform, discovery reform, things that where the process of determining justice is broken. We learned growing up where we have a system of innocence until proven guilty. But fundamentally, the way the system works is you're guilty until proven rich, because bail is simply paying for your freedom before you're convicted. That's the easiest way I can define what it does and what it means. Two people commit the same exact crime. One of them is on the streets if he has the wealth to pay his way out until trial. The other one is languishing in Rikers Island or some other jail while they wait. Oftentimes, charges get dropped or reduced in those instances. Kalief Browder is one of the most well-known examples of that. And what ends up happening is there's a perverse incentive that is used to get people to plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit. Because if you're sitting in Rikers for a relatively low-level crime, and you know it's going to be a year and a half, 2 years before you get to trial, and you can't afford bail to get out, and then the DA comes to you and offers you a plea to a crime where you'd probably be let out the next day because the crime is, the sentence would be so small that you've already served that time just waiting. A lot of people say yes. They plead guilty even though the crime has not been committed. Then what happens is they have a record. It becomes harder to get a job. It becomes harder to get into school. And their lives are ruined because of a system that's broken. There's no reason why we should have wealth be determinative of freedom in any way, shape, or form. That's what the bail system does, and we're going to try and change that.
Well, I certainly agree with what you've said, but are you worried that you'll be Willie Hortonized? In other words, that somebody will be let out without bail and that they'll go back to a serious crime and that somebody will point a finger at you, Mike, and say, Mike Gianaris, you did this.
Well, it's the perils of leadership to make decisions that are right, even though there might be political risk involved. The alternative to what you're suggesting is allow lives to be ruined. And I didn't get into public service to worry about my own hide. I did it to help people. And this is a very clear example where justice is being denied on a systemic level in our state. And there's something that we can do about it, and I intend to do it.
I got 2 minutes left. I'm going to ask you a one-minute question, which is going to be very hard to do. Let's start with marijuana, making it legal.
I support that. We got that in. We got that in just a few seconds.
That was good. Okay, let's talk about single-payer health care.
I do support that as well. We have to, you know, really roll up our sleeves and figure out implementation and details. The easiest way would be to get a federal waiver with this administration. No one expects that to happen. Gustavo Rivera is the just announced incoming chair of the Health Committee. The single-payer bill is his legislation. And I know he's already been talking to stakeholders and advocates, and we'll continue that conversation as we go into session. We want to move that forward. And then the question is how fast and what the details are. But we intend to make progress on that issue.
It won't be too expensive?
Well, that's one of the things we have to analyze and figure out. There are upfront costs by most independent analyses that get defrayed over time. So ultimately, there's significant savings in a plan like that. But the implementation period is one of disruption where there has to be some cost paid up front to set up the system and make the changes from the current one. That's the what I was talking about in terms of how we implement and how we get it done the right way.
1 minute left. I want to ask you about child victims. For some strange reason, the Republicans in the Senate would not, you know, not allow people a longer period to sue, as I understand it. Is that going to be changed?
It's not strange. It was a result of politics. So much was with the Republicans in the majority. One of their great constituencies is vehemently opposed to it, despite the merits of the bill. We expect that
you're talking about the church, right? You're talking about the church, right?
The Catholic Church, as well as other entities, but yes, predominantly them. And so we have been longstanding supporters of that. Brad Hoyleman carries that bill for us, and he's been the champion of it for years. We've all tried to force votes and taken votes on it, those of us that were in the Senate prior to next year. And I think you can expect real progress and seeing a Child Victims Act finally enacted in New York.
Mike Gianaris, what a pleasure to have you on the show. We have to do it more often. This has been The Capital Connection. And with State Senator Michael Gianaris, it's a great pleasure. Good luck, Mike, on everything that you're doing. And let's keep an eye on all of this. So,
thank you so much, Al.
See you soon. Thanks.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.